Hi. So I'll actually start off just by giving a summary of the paper. A lot of the really interesting discussion topics and issues seem to come out toward the end, so I'll give a summary all the way through and then raise three major topics for further discussion and some questions and issues. First, a quick sort of abstract version of the paper. Adam is calling into question, but ultimately defending the conciliationist commitment to agnosticism when it comes to many of our fundamental religious, philosophical, and political beliefs. He calls these FRPP beliefs at many points in the paper. He starts by noting some reasons that a ham-fisted route from conciliationist intuitions to agnosticism doesn't work. So we need a reason to think that disagreement provides an undercutting defeater for many of our FRPP beliefs. And he takes seriously a few challenges to this approach, coming from a 2013 paper from Grundmann. But Carter ultimately advances his own view, his own explanation of how disagreement generates an undercutting defeater in these cases, which he thinks gets around Grundmann's concerns. And he relies on the idea that it's irresponsible to traffic largely in beliefs in epistemically dangerous domains. Right, so walking through the paper, Adam begins with a rather extended discussion of opaque and non-opaque disagreements. So it's an observation that no plausible version of conciliationism is going to have us weaken doxastic attitudes in all cases where an epistemic peer disagrees with us. In particular, he's thinking about cases like one percenter, which is an island case where you know that basically everybody else agrees with you about P. 99 of 100 people agree with you, and you find out that one person believes not P. This shouldn't put any pressure on you rationally to conciliate or weaken your commitment. This is a counterexample where a case of an epistemic peer disagreeing doesn't put any pressure on you. And given this, it's not obvious, as some, you know, quote, ham-fisted conciliationists have seemed to think, that we're doomed to agnosticism in our FRPP beliefs. But then we have an argument for why these kinds of examples shouldn't be too comforting, because what these show is that extremely skewed non-opaque peer disagreements don't require doxastic modification, and this can be explained by something like the Condorcet jury theorem. Conciliationist intuitions, however, are still going to pull on us in the case of opaque peer disagreements, and importantly, non-opaque peer disagreements, where opinions are roughly equally divided. It's at least somewhat intuitive that in these cases, where there's genuine, not merely verbal, symmetric disagreement among epistemic peers, this is what Grundmann and Adam call GSE disagreement, that all parties will be rationally required to suspend judgment. This is the idea. And here we get into the challenges that Adam's considering from Grundmann. Why exactly does this conciliatory insight work? It seems like the conciliationist has to claim that this GSE disagreement constitutes a defeater. And here, Adam clarifies a few distinctions that have been drawn among defeaters. Undercutting versus rebutting defeaters, following Pollock, draws a distinction between doxastic and normative defeaters. It's natural for a conciliationist to say, and this is a suggestion coming from Matheson 2009, that GSE disagreement constitutes an undercutting defeater. We might want to think this is a normative undercutting defeater. But Grundmann raises two challenges for this kind of approach. First, Grundmann says it seems like the wrong level target. So an undercutting defeater for my belief that P would be evidence for, would rationally pressure me to believe not P, not that I wasn't justified in believing P. But widespread peer disagreement is on a higher order. It's most plausibly understood as evidence that we wouldn't be justified in believing we're justified in believing that P. And unless we want to be staunch internalists about justification, so where justification somehow entails a justified belief that one is justified, then we ought not to understand peer disagreement as a bona fide undercutting defeater at all. And this, the second challenge from Grundmann, so he thinks instead we should think of disagreement as a rebutting defeater, but But ultimately, you know, regardless of how we're thinking of the defeater is working exactly, it seems like the evidence is insufficient in the case of philosophy to constitute a normative defeater at all. Like, it seems like, at least to Grundmann, I can rationally deny that my putative philosophical peers are equally likely to get things right. And if I do so, I will lack even a doxastic defeater. Carter's response to these challenges addresses both points. First, he follows a thought from Bergman that uncertainty about whether one is justified in believing P can render one unjustified in believing that P, and we don't need strong internalism necessarily to make this claim. Moreover, importantly, the way that the undercutting defeater actually goes in the case of GSE disagreement, the evidence is compelling. We are obliged to doubt whether we're justified in our FRPP beliefs. This is because in FRPP domains, we don't have to assess our philosophical peers in order to acquire a defeater. We just have to look at the disagreement on central issues for our epistemic superiors. And at this point, we realize that there's clearly a general epistemic norm in play, and Carter spells out that norm for us. In what he calls epistemically dangerous domains, we ought not to traffic in beliefs. And epistemically dangerous domains are just those where our epistemic superiors are roughly equally divided on central, in contrast with peripheral, beliefs in the field. He thinks that philosophy and religion and politics, at least for most of us, are going to count as epistemically dangerous domains. And just to read a few quotes here, so we get the actual norm right. The general norm, for any subject matter phi, if phi is recognized as epistemically dangerous for S, S ought to believe that trafficking largely in phi beliefs is doxastically irresponsible. This principle is part and parcel with the familiar Jamesian point that the truth aim is to be understood, vis-a-vis belief forming, as one we should pursue in practice by affording an equal weight to attaining truths and avoiding error. Taking up beliefs, attitudes correct if and only if true, in epistemically dangerous subject matter is irresponsible insofar as it is at odds with affording equal weight to attaining truth and avoiding error. With respect to philosophy in particular, he says, namely, those aware that philosophy is an epistemically dangerous subject matter ought to believe that trafficking in beliefs is, on the whole, doxastically irresponsible. He goes on to say, but if we ought to believe trafficking in beliefs is, on the whole, doxastically irresponsible, then we have a straightforward kind of undercutting defeater for any particular fundamental philosophical belief that our evidence warrants us taking up an attitude of belief. The argument here has been advanced vis-a-vis philosophy, but it's hard to see how it wouldn't generalize to other areas that are epistemically dangerous. Religion and politics are obvious examples. Carter closes the paper with a very interesting suggestion that maybe the tripartite belief, disbelief, agnosticism solution space is too narrow-minded, and a conciliationist might plausibly adopt a weaker doxastic attitude than belief without being completely agnostic. Right, so if anything in that summary is wrong, Adam will have a chance very shortly to vindicate, to tell me that I've gotten something wrong. But I want to raise three topics for further discussion or families of questions and comments. First, I'm wondering about the relationship between this argument for RPP domains as epistemically dangerous and conciliationism in disagreement. So it's not clear to me that the argument for an undercutting defeater in epistemically dangerous domains relies on any particularly conciliationist intuitions. A conciliationist thinks that we rationally revise beliefs in response to disagreeing peers. But Adam's argument appeals to the disagreement of experts. And many who don't like conciliationism still think it's all right or even rationally required for us to defer to experts. You might think that where experts disagree, it's a kind of deference to them to resist trying to give one's own judgment on a matter. So it seems to me that some steadfastness theorists could agree with Carter's general point that trafficking in beliefs in epistemically dangerous situations is bad. On the other hand, if we think that this is a particularly conciliatory route to agnosticism. And if, as Carter notes in the paper, it's prima facie a good thing to hold FRPP attitudes, I wonder if this is really a strike against conciliationism. The steadfastness conciliationism debate would appear to be live in the epistemology of disagreement, and I'm wondering about the import of this argument on that broader conversation. The second topic I want to raise, I have questions and concerns about the scope of this argument and how it's to apply in a range of philosophical, religious, and political cases. So as an epistemic norm, if this requirement to suspend judgment in epistemically dangerous domains is an isolated fact about particularly bad epistemic situations, it might risk seeming arbitrary. So Adam describes the case where we're supposed to think it's dangerous to traffic in beliefs as being quite dire. Why exactly this dire? Why does it have to be my epistemic superiors disagreeing, and why does it have to be on central beliefs? If instead the genuine symmetric disagreement was among my peers, would I be under any pressure to become agnostic? To draw on one of Adam's examples, if I could become as good a philosopher as David Lewis, should disagreement in philosophy just not bother me then anymore? And to echo what I just said, that doesn't seem very conciliationist. Should we instead perhaps see the safety of trafficking in beliefs as a matter of degree? One might think that there are domains where we clearly ought to refrain from passing judgment and domains where we clearly may, but plausibly a lot of interesting cases are going to fall somewhere in the middle. What are we supposed to do when our epistemic superiors are split 75-25, or when it's difficult to tell exactly how that split falls out? One would hope for a unified treatment and not just a specification that this really bad situation is bad and requires agnosticism. And relatedly, I'm wondering about just how much of an epistemically dangerous domain needs to be off limits. So philosophers opine on some questions that are not so controversial. For example, relativism about knowledge attributions, which is one of Carter's examples in the paper. But he seems at some places, at least, to suggest that all of philosophy and all of religion and all of politics is implicated as epistemically dangerous. And this would be a puzzling claim, needing arguing. In particular, it would seem to guarantee that Carter will be vulnerable to self-undermining objections. The standard form of that objection probably bears saying, how can he write a philosophy paper advancing a controversial philosophical thesis if philosophy is an epistemically dangerous domain for him? I'm very interested to hear his response, but one response he might not want to close off is that at least some conciliationist intuitions are widely shared and thus pretty safe. This might also tempt us to wonder just how dangerous philosophy in general, all of it, really is, or religion or politics. The more dire a situation needs to be to warrant agnosticism, the more difficult it will be to establish that philosophy, politics, and religion are all like that. And Adam doesn't consider some other typical arguments for why FRPP beliefs don't require conciliation. I think we'll be hearing more about one such argument tomorrow. One might argue that FRPP disagreements, unlike general restaurant cases, generally boil down to differences in our unshareable starting points, or that the evidence adduced for such claims is largely unshareable, say because it's largely based on first-personal evidence like experiences. And if this is the case, it's extremely difficult or impossible to identify proper epistemic superiors in RPP domains. This seems particularly plausible in the case of religion. I'm wondering what Adam could say to someone who simply denies that religion or philosophy or politics is an area where we can clearly see that our epistemic superiors disagree. Right, so my third topic I want to raise is to question whether trafficking in beliefs in epistemically dangerous domains is really problematic across the board. Adam's Jamesian justification for this is interesting. A Jamesian line actually seems to me to support the opposite conclusion. And you might think that two different kinds of Jamesians could argue for this in different ways. One way to go would be to say, sure, reasonable people value getting truth as much as avoiding error. So where I think I have a 50-50 shot at getting truth, say via trusting some particular epistemic superior, it's rationally permissible, although just barely, for me to adopt a stance. Or a different kind of Jamesian might say, sure, reasonable people may weight these virtues equally in general, but within the specific domains of philosophy, religion, and politics, there's more going on that seems pertinent to weighting these virtues. For one thing, some of the questions seem forced in James's sense. To abstain from any political stance is itself to take a political stance. For another, one might think that knowing the truth of some, for example, religious propositions, may be far more important or beneficial than avoiding error, an argument in the spirit of Pascal. Basically, reasonable people take risks when they have to, or when they reasonably think it's worth it. And why may I not do so in these domains? Right, and then one final request before I turn it over to Adam. I thought the closing suggestion was extremely interesting. I would love to hear a little bit more about how a weaker doxastic attitude could provide a satisfying response for the conciliationist who wants to keep some FRPP doxastic attitudes. Thanks.
Well, thank you for those comments. There are some very helpful things that you said right there. It struck me that it can seem right as you're writing your own paper when you're writing the thoughts down, but to have your ideas read back to you is what you said. Sometimes it sounds like I'd said some stupider things as you're reading them back to me. it's like you don't want to have what you said read right back to you. So I see a number of things that that I did wrong in the paper as a result of thinking through some of your comments, so I appreciate those. I'm going to try to address as many of those as I can. First off, a dialectical point that I should have made clear and which wasn't clear enough in the title of the paper. So a central aim of the paper was to explore how the conciliatory argument for agnosticism based on conciliatory insights might plausibly generate the conclusion that we have to be agnostic about most of our religious philosophical beliefs, a conclusion that's often taken to be a direct implication of that position, that we'd be agnostic about these types of beliefs. And it was suggested why we should ultimately accept a variation of this conclusion that's associated normally with the conciliatory view. But of course, you're completely right that the argument presented in the closing section relies on insights that aren't conciliatory. So that's absolutely right. So I'm happy to say up front that I'm thereby not endorsing a conciliatory approach insofar as some of my remarks go against that. I take myself to be offering, I'll say for reasons of it, kind of an alternative to the conciliatory or the steadfast approach. So some further rationale, you might say, why do I need to move to discussing experts, right? Because I specifically discuss the types of disagreements that I think constitute and can generate normative undercutting defeaters in terms of subject matters where we have roughly divided expert disagreement. And you might wonder, why not just take a more conciliatory line and say, well, what really matters is that there are subject matters that, if they're such that there's roughly symmetrical peer disagreement, that might be good enough to generate the kind of normative undercutting defeater. Well, I'm thinking, you can imagine a case where suppose that I'm very dull and uninformed on a topic, and it's very likely that my epistemic peers, in which case, who are also going to be dull and uninformed on a topic, they will then be my epistemic peers, right? Dullards and people who don't have much evidence. Plausibly, dull and uninformed people are going to disagree about topics central to most subject matters. And the worry would then be, if I framed it this way, that just as long as your epistemic peers are roughly divided about central subject matters, you could generate a more wide-scoping mandate for agnosticism than is plausibly warranted, because you can imagine for most subject matters, there's a class of people who are intellectually impoverished badly enough that they're going to disagree roughly symmetrically on central subject matters. So that's why I framed it in terms of experts. You ask the good question, well, could you see the proposal that I offer, which again is a proposal that, let's not be agnostic, but rather the types of disagreements that we have mandate that we take weaker doxastic attitudes than belief. So this, I am saying it is okay to take those attitudes. We should be trafficking largely in those types of attitudes in certain subject matters. You say, if that's right, well then, isn't that a strike against conciliationism? And also, wouldn't the steadfast conciliation debate be live? So I'd say, in short, yes, it's a strike against conciliationism. When we examine the conciliatory argument for agnosticism, it turns out to be the best reason, I think, to ultimately accept the conclusion that's normally associated with the conciliationist approach is actually a kind of rationale that is going to be at odds with conciliationism insofar as it does permit not withholding, but actually taking up certain weaker doxastic attitudes. So in that respect, it is a direct strike against conciliationism. On the other hand, there's a spirit in which the view that I offer could be read as more along the lines of the conciliatory approach than the other approach, which is to say that I'm offering a proposal according to which facts about disagreement can then require that we rationally suspend at least beliefs, even if not weaker states. So, kind of in a nutshell, I would say, if I'm right, and the proposal I offer not in enough depth toward the end, the steadfastness approach is wrong to traffic in beliefs in these areas. However, the conciliatorist response is wrong to think that such areas would be ones where withholding is implicator is rationally required. So in a sense, I would say that they're both wrong for different reasons. You ask, you know, you worry about it being maybe an arbitrary way to characterize the type of disagreements that I'm thinking are actually causing the relevant trouble. And you say, why does it have to be central beliefs, for instance, was one of the questions you raised. Well, the idea that the disagreement in questions in the relevant subject matters have to be over disagreements that are central to the subject matter as opposed to peripheral, and here I'm borrowing from Quanbing's way of distinguishing subject matter and central and peripheral beliefs, is that if we widen the class of beliefs about a subject matter such that expert disagreement will generate for us a normative defeater, then I worry that the argument will overgeneralize and include nearly every subject matter. And my thought here is, this is based information based on a documentary. So Ernest Shackleton, Polar Exploration. So we have good reason to believe that for most subject matters, there are experts who disagree roughly symmetrically about some propositions that are on the periphery of that subject matter. So take, for instance, two historians in the subject matter of the exploration of the South Pole. And my thought is that experts on the subject matter don't disagree anywhere approaching symmetrically about whether Ernest Shackleton's ship was trapped in the Weddell Sea during the famous voyage of the Endurance. Let's say that that's a pretty important proposition. But experts, let's say they probably will disagree about peripheral issues such as whether the crew ate more penguins than seals to survive on Elephant Island. And the fact that there might be experts who disagree about that type of thing shouldn't matter, I don't think, for the purpose of generating the type of undercutting defeater that I'm talking about. So that's why I chose central beliefs. You ask a very good question. Are we supposed to take it then that where the genuine symmetric disagreement is among my peers, I wouldn't have to become agnostic? And then you give the David Lewis example. That's a very good point. You mentioned if I were to become as good a philosopher as David Lewis, disagreement in philosophy shouldn't bother me. So obviously that's something I need to have something to say about. So my response would be that on the type of view that I'm proposing, whether symmetric, and this is something I should stress more in the paper, whether symmetric peer disagreement vis-a-vis subject matter X can generate a normative undercutting defeater, I think depends importantly on who your epistemic peers are. So on the assumption that David Lewis is an expert, let's just assume that X hypothesis in some relevant subject matter, then his epistemic peers will de facto be experts. And thus it would be true that for Lewis, roughly symmetric disagreement among his epistemic peers in a subject matter X can generate a normative undercutting defeater for beliefs in area X. But what you say there then bothered me in a good sense for you that you made me worry. I think there's a related case. So I think the David Lewis case can be handled just by saying if he's an expert, then he should worry because his peers are experts. But what about cases like this? What about cases in which someone is intelligent and reasonably well-informed on topic X, but not quite an expert? And it turns out that that individual finds out that even though there is an expert disagreement on central beliefs vis-a-vis the subject matter, that individual's epistemic peers disagree. That would be a bolder argument for the type of agnosticism that I'm proposing, because it allows a sort of a stronger line to be taken on in the original kind of premise that what types of cases could rationally mandate agnosticism. It would be a larger class of cases, both expert disagreement and disagreement among people who are pretty intelligent and reasonably well informed. I'm opting for a more cautious line, in which case the only types of cases that I want to positively say I think should warrant us to back down from beliefs and adopt a weaker attitude are cases in which there's recognized experts that are roughly divided on central topics. But I don't think that the problem case I mentioned would necessarily be an indefensible argument. It's just a little bit stronger than what I would feel comfortable arguing for. You ask about the 75-25 case by saying that one might think that there are you said that one might think that there are domains where we clearly ought to refrain from passing judgment and domains where we clearly may pass judgment, but don't most interesting cases fall somewhere in the middle? I think that's a really good question. And it led me to realize that there's something you seem to be tacitly maybe agreeing to up front, which is that it seems like at least there are some areas where we shouldn't pass judgment. And you don't explicitly say that, but you indicate that you might think something like that. And I realize that there's two ways of reading that claim, and that I'm talking about one particular way, and basically I'll say there that there's a person-relative way of reading the claim that roughly we should refrain from passing judgment on a certain subject area. On the person-relative way, we might say that for person S in domain D, whether S ought to refrain from passing judgment about, say, fundamental claims in D depends on S's evidential predicament vis-a-vis D. On this personal reading, this is a very normal way to read that claim. Phil Mickelson can pass judgment about the best strategies for hitting a golf shot into the wind, whereas my mother should refrain from passing judgment on this type of a thing. Though on this reading, there needn't be any further fact about the subject matter that Phil is engaged with that makes it dangerous, right? But setting aside the person-relative interpretation, right, I'm talking about a way of thinking about certain subject matters where there would be an additional fact over and above the matter of what I happen to have evidence about, right? And the further fact would be, is this a subject matter such that the relevant experts in that field are roughly divided about central questions? Now, to the extent that you're tacit seeming to agree that there might be subject matters where we should refrain from passing judgment, it is intended in the kind of second sense that I mean, then I would wonder, what is it about some subject matters such that anyone should back down from trafficking largely in beliefs about them, or we should refrain from judgment? And there I would think that it seems like whatever you might be tacitly thinking about when thinking about such subject matters, if indeed you would make that claim in the second sense, I would press that perhaps the story I gave is a pretty good one. If we want to think about what would make a subject matter such that we ought to back away from trafficking largely in beliefs about it, I think that the bare fact that it turns out that experts are roughly divided about central claims and subject matter is a pretty good characterization of what it is about these types of subject matters. But, of course, you might not have been intending to conceive the idea that there are such domains. Now, about the specific 75-25 point, that's just a really good question. The way that I frame the argument is if experts are roughly divided. And so I kind of thought, well, around 50-50. If you look at the Phil Papers survey, that gives a rough indication. And Platonism and nominalism is really roughly 50-50. I think it's actually 50-50. But of course, I think that it doesn't need to be the case that it has to be split exactly 50-50 among experts. I think that plausibly, if it's around there, and I think that it might be that 75-25 might be a kind of borderline case, although I would say that 60-40 is close enough. 75-25 might be a borderline case, but I hadn't thought about that. I just was relying on the rough idea of when experts are roughly split, so I think that was a good point to press me on. So you say, let's see, Also, the direness of the description of epistemic loop. By the way, how many minutes have I carried on?
8 more minutes.
8 more minutes, okay, cool. You say the direness of the description of epistemically dangerous domains makes it a non-trivial claim that religion, politics, and philosophy are all like that. Well, that is right. So I was assuming that they are like that, but in assuming that they are like that, I spoke too loosely in the paper in several points. I don't want to say that all of philosophy is like that. As you rightly point out, and I discussed this also, there are some issues where philosophers are not really divided. And according to the Phil Paper survey, John McFarlane is a very smart guy. He is in the group that thinks that we should take on a relativist semantics about knowledge attributions, but he's definitely in the minority. There's only about 2% of philosophers, at least, that took the survey that thought that. About 98% think that that position is false. So that isn't an example in which there's a philosophical problem where the experts don't seem to be divided. And so in the paper, I apologize, I sometimes spoke free and loose when I say in philosophy. I need to be more careful about that, but know that I wasn't meaning every single area of philosophy, and that's something I need to be more, I need to qualify better. So what I did, I wasn't trying to give a proposal of epistemically dangerous subject areas such that they generate a normative undercutting to Feeder in a way that smuggles implicitly the idea that philosophy, religion, and politics are just definitely included, like conceptually, in the idea of what this thing is. Rather, the idea is that any subject matter that has the sort of properties that I attributed to epistemically dangerous subject matters are ones that we should back down a little bit from our beliefs about. And as I think, and I didn't go into any empirical results supporting this claim, there are probably surveys that would support this claim, but I didn't say this. I take it that, is libertarianism true? There are certain very widely, maybe fundamental claims in various domains of discourse, political theory, ethics, where I suspect that you're going to find the experts, whoever we would normally identify the experts to be roughly divided. And it's those subject areas that I'm talking about. So I think it would be crazy to take philosophy entirely. Of course, I meant the areas in philosophy where there is roughly entrenched disagreements such as Platonism versus nominalism, but I spoke sometimes otherwise. You ask a domain question, you say, well, how much is going to come down among these disciplines on the proposal that I'm offering? And I don't know. So certainly, I don't think that we should form, and I'm completely committed to saying we shouldn't form beliefs about whether or not Platonism or nominalism is true. We should traffic in weaker doxastic attitudes on that particular topic. But unfortunately, I realize, after seeing some of your remarks, that I say something that indicates a much stronger position later on in the paper. And when I expand this into a longer paper and deal with some of these issues that you've raised, this is something I'm going to want to cover my tracks on. What I suggested later, right, is that if a subject matter is such that there's experts that are roughly divided on topics central to the subject matter, then what I said was that this creates a normative undercutting to Feeder, and that it suggests that I ought not traffic largely in beliefs in that area. One that then, I thought, serves as a kind of undercutting to Feeder for particular beliefs in that subject area. There's a way of reading that that generates a really implausible view for me, which is that since, you could say that metaphysics is a central topic in philosophy, and sure enough, we find people who are expert or recognized experts divided quite closely on fundamental topics there. Now, a way of reading my view that I definitely don't want to endorse is the idea that therefore that's going to generate for any particular philosophical view or for any particular metaphysical view a type of undercutting to Feeder, because I don't think that. And this is something I'm going to need to be sharper in my presentation of how the view is going to work so that I don't get that type of result. But you're absolutely right to press that point. although I would resist your description of the disciplines as coming down, I would say that, you know, if I say that we have to be skeptics about claims in these views, then yeah, I would say it's all just coming down. I'm saying, well, we sort of take the raft of epistemic humility down, just slide it to the side a little bit, where we adopt a slightly weaker attitude. So we're not, it would come down, I think, if you just can't form any representational states on anything. I'm suggesting maybe a little bit more epistemically humble vis-a-vis the type of representational attitudes we state towards claims, which I would say, it's not really coming down, it's just shifting a little bit, but that's just a small point. Let's see. Oh, self-undermining. Of course, I have to answer the self-undermining charge. I offer consistency on the self-undermining charge. So, it sounds crazy, right, to say, well, I don't believe what I'm saying. This is plausibly even more paradoxical. But I think it is, there's a way of reading this idea that's the right thing to say in an area in which discourse is entrenched amongst experts. And all I mean is that the conclusion of my argument, that it might be, I'm not even sure, I think Adam Elga has a paper that I haven't read on this about how to disagree, that paper, where he engages in this topic. But let's just suppose that this is one of those areas like Platonism and nominalism, and I've entered the debate with a particular stance that should I believe what I'm saying? I think that because I'm entering a, what would be on my view, an epistemically dangerous area, what I should do is take up an attitude that's not individuated as belief would be individuated on the hierarchy of attitudes, vis-a-vis how that belief sets out to attain truths as opposed to avoid error. So belief, unlike mere suspicions, you know, might be the weakest attitude that would normally suffice for rational action or something like that, maybe. I don't think that I'm taking up an attitude that an attitude that's at that place on the hierarchy. I would suggest that I'm taking an attitude slightly lower than that. Of course, I anticipate another objection that you could raise right along those lines and say, well, if that's the case, then surely you're making assertions in philosophy. That's what we normally do. We assert stuff. But if something like knowledge or justified belief or something like that is the norm of assertion, then how can I countenance the idea that I'm making assertions when doing philosophy? Well, here, and Matt Benton might not like that I'm going to use a recent paper that he's done with John Terry on predictions, but I think that there's an answer to that particular objection that could be found in there. And of course, you might just think that it's illicit the way that I'm appealing to what you did, but you guys identify sort of a broad class of assertives at the beginning of the paper. And so Benton and Terry say that the class of assertives includes guessing. That's a pretty low down on the hierarchy. Conjecturing, that's an assertive. Hedged asserting, flat out asserting. And then of course you get to stronger varieties of assertives. Very strong one would be guaranteeing, right? I would say that the sort of speech act that I'm engaged in when I'm saying stuff right now, and at least on a topic, if we suppose that it's playing this, that's, one for which there's roughly divided experts. I'd say this can be lower than belief, right? I'm gonna say it's something like a suspicion or a conjecture. And I'll also say that the relevant speech act that's gonna be associated with what I'm doing, my cognitive representation, is gonna be something just a little bit weaker along the hierarchy of assertives. So I would say, yes, I agree, I'm not making what would normally function as an assertive on that, on the hierarchy. It's gonna be something a little bit weaker. And then I would just say, but I'm happy to say that that's what I'm doing. Because I really think I could be wrong very well, because I'm entering into dangerous waters when trying to carve out a position in a debate like this. How am I doing on time?
A little bit over,
okay.
You want to make
well,
sure.
The final remark, you said something at the end that would be a disaster for me, and it really caused me concern. And I'm just gonna have to reject the way that I originally characterized belief as an attitude that's individuated as one that equally weights the goal of attaining truth and avoiding error. I think I had an idea in mind when I was describing it this way, which is that the weight that we give to avoiding error is substantial enough in the case of individuating the attitude of belief that it's not going to be an attitude that would be appropriate to take up when we have this fact in the back of our heads about experts disagreeing on stuff in the area. But of course, you come in and say, well, if that's the case, then if you equally weigh truth and avoid error, and that's what belief is individuated as, then surely I should just form a belief on a coin flip, because then I would be assigning equal weight. Well, of course, I don't want to say that. And so I thought about how to articulate this, and I would say that maybe blind guessing, here's a way, but I'm not sure. Blind guessing might provide a baseline weighting, and absolute certainty provides maybe a top-line weighting. We might think of belief as occupied somewhere in between those two. But that is a point that I'll want to think about more carefully, and because I don't want to say that you want to believe anything on a coin flip. Well, I'll shut up after that. Thanks.
So we'll move to questions. We'll acknowledge the finger-hands distinction. Keep your hands up until I give you a knowing glance. We'll start with Helen.
Yes, so I'm wondering how would you, I think it's interesting to look at experts for peer disagreement. I think that's an interesting thing. But how narrow would you see this? So a while ago, I wrote a blog post about the fact that the Field Papers survey, the philosophers of religion, about 75% of them accept or lean towards theism, and 25% reject it. And whereas in the general philosophy population, it's like 16% accept theism and the remainder reject it. So I said, okay, look, if we take conciliationism and, you know, deference to experts, etc., seriously, then we should put considerable epistemic weight on the fact that philosophers of religion, the experts on religion, if there is such a thing as expertise on religion, are peers to the most part. But then I got a strange response that actually they're epistemic inferiors because they are so, you know, caught up with their, you know, they're sort of like blinded because of it. So I don't know what you make of this and how you would approach this case given your general framework.
Well, that's a very good question. Was that post on the new apps?
I think, yeah.
I think I read that a while ago.
Yeah.
It was a cool post. So here's the way I try to think about who the epistemic peers experts would be. I think it's a very tough question. I didn't say what I thought that an epistemic expert was in the paper, although I hinted to what I thought it was. Well, here's my thinking on the matter. So Jennifer Lackey, fortunately, has a talent for taking a complex issue and just really making it really clear, I find. And she has a simple way of thinking about how to identify an epistemic peer. And I think that using her formula to identify an epistemic expert would be a way to make sense of it. So she thinks of peerhood as a function of cognitive and evidential equality. I think Feldman also adds like a full disclosure condition to it as well. But that would be relevant for getting the doxastic revision requirement off the ground. If we're just going to identify who an epistemic peer is, let's just take that as a starting point. Okay, there might cognitive and evidential equals, but not just my cognitive and evidential equals, because I might have, because what's relevant is cognitive and evidential equals vis-a-vis whether P, right, the target proposition. So if my peers, if Lackey's right that my peers are my people that are roughly as smart as me and know roughly as much about whether P, then presumably the experts are going to be people that are both, or at least one or the other, right? Maybe it's someone who's just a whole lot smarter than me but has the same evidence. Maybe that person could be an epistemic superior or expert. I'm not sure. I would imagine, oh crap, I realize I just traded on a confusion. So there's the issue of who are my epistemic superiors, and then there's the issue of how to identify the experts. I would say that the experts would be a certain class of my superiors that probably are better than I am along both of those dimensions. Now, specifying the narrow class of who are really the experts beyond just the people that are smarter than you and have more evidence, I think that's tricky. I would normally appeal to something like, well, it's kind of recognized. It's a socially recognized fact in a lot of cases, but sometimes socially recognized facts get it completely wrong, which is why
you've
got that.
Here it's difficult.
Who's
right?
That guy that did the debate against the science guy?
Ken Ham.
You realize, I think a lot of people will watch that probably, this guy's speaking, he's speaking as an expert.
Yes.
He might be an expert of something, but it might be.
Getting money from.
Mm-hmm. So we have to caution against the socially recognized roles of experts in making that assessment. But it's something like a high end of the class of people who are my epistemic superiors on Lackey's terms, would be my guess. But there's probably a better theory for what an expert is than that.
So we've got some fingers, Tim O'Connor.
And I'm giving up my regular thing because it's related, so I just.
Your hand became a finger.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Hold on to my head. So it's just a quick question, Adam. It's how you think about these sociological snapshot facts about the profession and why that should be at all relevant. So you cited this, you know, this kind of large unscientific survey of philosophers as of a couple of years ago or something. And, you know, the 98% too, you wouldn't worry about that sort of case, but, you know,
yeah.
It's roughly, I'm just thinking, you know, we don't have to be, you know, going for kind of radical theses about the sociology of knowledge to acknowledge that there is a real sociological dynamic we're working in our profession as in every other. It's a self-selecting profession. People choose to go into it. It's a random distribution of the population. Who, you know, what field someone chooses to go into is, you know, maybe going to be correlated with certain, you know, tendency to be friendly to certain kinds of views, that the outsized influence of certain
That's
figures,
right.
quite apart from their the force of their arguments, just the force of their personality. J.L. Austin famously, not to, you know, give any contemporary examples that might make people nervous, but, you know, that kind of thing. So I think that's worthless. I wouldn't want to make it. I'm not addressing your broader point, but you're making the differentiation.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
That I'm very skeptical of.
Well, in the paper, so I use that example to kind of as a somewhat idealized case, and you're absolutely right about that. But one place where I parted ways with the type of approach that I think you might be worried that I was suggesting, which is that in order to locate who the experts are, let's just look at a biased, perhaps highly contingent field paper survey that's slightly outdated. I definitely don't think that. I just looked at that as an example of what might be an idealized case. But I think that our cases where we actually run into normative undercutting defeaters in the sense that I explore in the paper won't be ones where we have any hard data, and I say that in the paper. They will rather be cases that are like this. And this is to align myself somewhat with John Matheson's way of thinking about undercutting defeaters. So in the case of, well, let's say in epistemology, gosh, I mean, I've talked to a lot of epistemologists and I've never really taken a survey about, you know, who's an externalist and who's an internalist. I just kind of know who they are, roughly. I sort of know what to expect from people who have these types of entrenched commitments. Now, I don't need to see any stats, I don't think, on the proposal that I want to offer in order for this fact about the way people, I have a sense that people think about internalism and externalism and about epistemic justification to be enough to make me think that, geez, it's very likely that there's not, I have a sense of serious uncertainty about whether there would be any type of uniformity amongst the alleged or recognized experts about a position like this. And that's enough to do the job. So my view would be worse if I required some sort of a specific piece of hard data and then I would rely on something that's like highly contingent like that. But I want to make a stronger claim and say that we don't need particular pieces of data like that. We just simply need to have significant uncertainty.
Actual uncertainty. So were we to contemplate how likely it might
be
that there could have been uncertainty where there's not a great deal of it in the 98.2%, but it could easily, it seems as an epistemic matter, could easily have gone such that it would have been more like a 50-50 case.
Yeah.
Certain historical figures hadn't had the influence they did.
So that's
someone
the way that's the way the view shaped now. Because you can imagine a case where someone has misleading but excellent evidence for thinking that the experts are broadly unanimous on a case in which they're actually divided. On the at least on the way that I've worked out the view so far, that doesn't generate for that individual an undercutting normative defeater. All it takes is actual uncertainty or positive evidence that there would, as in the case of, that's why I used the Phil Surveys case, if you have some type of positive evidence to think that the experts are roughly divided.
So,
thanks for the question.
Yeah, this is a follow-up too about experts within philosophy on certain topics that are philosophical topics and maybe central claims. So think about external world skepticism and the view that external skepticism is false. we, in fact,
the view that
it's false, that external skepticism is false. That seems to be a philosophical sort of claim, and take views that that it's that independently of what I think, it's wrong to torture infants. And in those kinds of cases, there's disagreement. Who are the experts? So you mentioned Jennifer Lackey's way of thinking about it. I guess I think something along those same lines. You might say that an expert would be, or at least a peerhood would be, you know, you have equally good evidence and you're equally good at responding to that evidence. Okay, and then of course, as you say, it's got to be relativized to the proposition in question. Well, I mean, what if the evidence in the case of rejecting external moral skepticism is trusting our epistemic intuitions, the sort that Moore brought to our attention, that clearly I know this is a hand. And the people who are experts are, you know, aren't philosophers necessarily. I mean, they could be. If they're in touch with their common sense roots, then they're doing fine too.
Yeah.
But anybody, could be philosophical or not, could be an expert. And the same thing with, you know, I know it's wrong to torture infants. And then the question is, what about believing God? Who are the experts? You know, I know a
yeah.
philosopher who said,
that's very
and so a philosopher who said to me, I feel grateful when I look at sunsets. And he was an atheist. I said, well, who are you grateful to? You could say, a theist could say, well, such a person, he's not very good at responding to his evidence. Right? He shares the evidence that theists have, which inclines him to be grateful to God in response to the beauty of a sunset. But he doesn't respond well to it. And it's got nothing to do with his intelligence as a philosopher. So I guess I think that this talk of experts, and then you recognize all the smart people around you who disagree with you,
yeah.
that kind of intelligence seems kind of irrelevant to some of the expertise. Maybe on internalism and externalism, that's more relevant, and there's more of a reason to be agnostic. But on some of these simple things, simple in a certain sense, it seems like it doesn't require expertise amongst, you know, with a PhD, for example.
I think it would depend. So in the case of the external world, one might wonder. So I've read part of this paper. I think it's mental, but I don't entirely understand the theoretical physics of it. But Nick Bostrom thinks that it's more likely that we're in a simulation. Is that, he actually thinks that?
Well, so suppose that the issue of whether it's we're in a simulation, and the likelihood of a simulation, is something that is relevant to the matter of the issue of external world skepticism, then one might suggest that the ordinary person that can look at hands lacks a kind of relevant piece of familiarity with a certain type of data. That was just a quick side thought on that. But regarding external world skepticism, I see why you would make the remark that you did, and I think that's a good point. It seems like, how do you determine who the experts are when it looks like what is relevant to bear on that particular question is you see the world around you, and it looks like most people, philosophers or otherwise, seem to be in the same type of epistemic position with regard to that.
Well, it's also the higher level sort of that this is a rational thing to think.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I mean, I guess a lot of people don't think about that, but if you were to quiz them on it, they'd probably say, yeah, that's perfectly reasonable to think that. I've
mean, yeah.
Or a skeptic
says, I think that's a really good question. One related problem that I was worried about regarding that is, I want to think more about the external world skeptic case, because there's a sense in which I think we might, that Moore's proof reveals that one reason that it's not intellectually satisfying is that sort of the evidence that's contained in the premise is evidence that everyone already shares. So it sounds as though he could bring you to rational conviction by showing you reasons that you already have, but can't give anything better, right, to bear on the conclusion than something you already have. But take the case of Graham Priest. So how do we distinguish the subject matter of, is it logic or is it dialethist logic? It looks like on one certain description of the relevant subject matter, it looks like, well, probably, and this is probably true, there's probably no one that's thought about dialethism more than Graham Priest has. And well, his opinion is that it's true. And so it seems as though if we construed narrowly enough the subject matter, it looks like, well, gosh, dude, there's no disagreement. There's no disagreement at all amongst the experts. There's only one proper expert about dialethism, and that person agrees with it. I think that's a bad view. I personally don't understand anyone could be a dialethist, but I'm not as smart as Graham Priest. He would be able to understand much better. But it seems like the experts really aren't divided on that topic, right? It seems like he's pretty far on one side, and most people think that that's false. But what is a problem for me is that I'm not entirely sure how to delineate the relevant subject matter to not be ad hoc or arbitrary in the Graham Priest case, so as to not get the implausible result that the experts are unanimous that that's true. So there are problems in that neighborhood that I'll want to think about more carefully.
Thanks. One more finger in the blue. Are you John?
Yeah.
Yeah, good.
Just one comment on previous things that have been said and then a further question about it. It just might be helpful to distinguish between what you might call conventional expertise and reliability expertise. Like Elga's way, for instance, of talking about peerage and expertise is in terms of your own estimate of the likelihood or reliability that someone gets it right. And I mean, what I think Mike is kind of drawing our attention to, Tim as well, is that those two notions can come apart fairly radically. I don't think my mom would ever call herself, you know, an expert on, say, God's existence or on the nature of free will or something. However, I think she would think she probably, in the reliability sense of expertise,
yeah,
more expert than some nameless philosopher at a prestigious university.
Yeah.
And I think the argument does require reliability expertise. A question I have, though, is if this is a conciliationist type argument, there's got to be something like an independence kind of requirement coming into the judgment of who qualifies as an expert. So let me ask you this question, which tries to tease out whether you're wanting to endorse that sort of requirement. So let's say that I want to look at the experts on libertarianism, say, and I say, well, but you know, who are the experts? They're people who have a good track record. So say I have all the data behind the Phil Paper survey, and I say, well, look, I'm going to look at the people who got it right on the theism question. Suddenly libertarianism, it's doing a little bit better. But I also want to look at the people who got it right on, you know, whatever other metaphysics question. And I start going down the list. Of course, I'm not, you know, I don't want to be question begging with respect to the libertarian debate. So I don't look at that. But by the time I've kind of ferreted out the most reliable people based on all these other issues, you know, I have, assuming that there's some correlations among these, and now I'm looking at people who look a lot like me on everything except this, I haven't done that filter. You know, the experts agree with me. And of course, there may be a few independent kind of issues where that procedure is not going to get rid of the disagreement. But I mean, this is kind of related to Elga's case of Anne and Beth on abortion. And well, do they disagree on a cluster of issues? And there's certain questions about how to handle that. And I guess my question to you is, you know, is that procedure legitimate, that subjective way of getting at expertise? Or do I need to do something that's a little bit more independent of my stance, even on ancillary, but or on close by, related but distinct issues.
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. I'm not sure. Right now, I feel like I was in developing the insight, which I still think is right. If it were the case that experts, suppose X hypothesis, we have good evidence, or that experts are roughly divided, then we ought to tone down our dark sense of state. That still strikes me as right, But it only does because I'm thinking about paradigmatic cases in which the issue about who the experts doesn't come up originally. So in those cases, I continue to hold the view. What I'm very unclear now about is, and this particularly, the very tricky question of religion. What method could one undertake to determine who the religious experts are? I find that really difficult. One thing that led me to question whether there could be philosophical expertise in certain areas of philosophy, and I toyed with this actually after reading one of Alison Hill's papers about moral testimony. So you might think that here's a prerequisite for a field admitting of the property of having expertise. So there can't be maybe experts on some non-factive made-up field. They could be charlatans that masquerade as experts, but there might not be any expertise there. You might say, well, a domain of discourse admits of expertise just in case there are individuals who can convey testimony, convey knowledge testimony on that domain, and that I can come to know facts relevant to the domain of discourse just by testimony. Now, a worry is, maybe metaethics isn't such a discipline. Maybe metaethics doesn't have any expertise. And the worry would be that suppose I want to know, maybe first order ethics, let's just take that. Suppose I want to know how to live, what is the good life?
well, I could go to ask Michael Smith, and he might just say, look, I'm going to save you the soul searching and the trouble. I'm just going to tell you, do this. It seems worrying to me to think that I can attain moral knowledge so cheaply just by taking the word of a recognized expert. But maybe this, and then the worry that I was mentioning to you is maybe this counts, this is a consideration that could count against the idea that, well, perhaps the reason that we can't acquire knowledge via testimony in this area of discourse is that there aren't any proper experts. Now, of course, that would be a problem for my argument if it turns out that there aren't experts in the field, I think, because, of course, then you can't have roughly divided disagreement among them. But I think that there are a nest of problems in the issue of identifying experts that I don't have sorted out.
So long, okay, one finger, and then we've got a long list of questions.
Right.
So
just on this, about the rough division of experts, if we set lights to people's views because we see the experts are roughly divided, so the next generation looks up at their superiors epistemologically and say, oh, well, they're divided, we don't know what to think. Come in the next generation, there are no experts left in that field, then everybody just says, I don't know.
I don't know that they'd have to say I appreciate the point.
But there aren't any acknowledged experts left. That's the point.
So, your idea is that. Well, I'm sorry, can you run it one more time about.
You're saying there's a tremendous division between acknowledged experts. Should make people who perhaps are particularly more junior respect this and say, well, we must be very careful here what to think. We mustn't go on one side or the other. Agnosticism is one possibility. Now, I'm saying that's not the way to generate experts in a field. And if you look at, for instance, at cosmology, where there's a lot of disagreement, the cosmologists of the next generation will have to be people putting forward bold theses, which we hope can be tested.
Yeah.
But if there aren't people left putting those theses forward because they believe in them, because they say, well, it's all very difficult and there's all this disagreement, where are you?
Okay. I'm on track. So I think that there's no problem, and it's a requirement of my proposal, if I'm right, that what experts should do is adopt weaker doxastic states. Now one might say, well, is there a sort of a priori tension between the idea of an individual being an expert and the idea of an individual trafficking merely on the subject in which he's an alleged or she's an alleged expert and representational states that are weaker than belief? But I don't think so, because right now I think that this generation and the next might well continue to recognize that, gosh, the question of Platonism versus nominalism, that is entrenched. It's been entrenched for generations, apparently, and probably will continue to be an entrenched debate of divisions. However, David Lewis and Peter Van Inwagen are going to have a certain type of expertise, and I'm happy to attribute to them that my mother, who just hates it when I try to tell her about my papers, then she's going to have. And I think that there's a serious difference between my mother and Peter Van Inwagen on that question. And even if it isn't explained in Van Inwagen trafficking in beliefs or strong convictions, that his expertise would continue to be compatible with trafficking in strong conjectures or something like that.
But isn't the fact that there's been this division between Platonism and nominalism through the generations a possible argument for saying, well, let's give up on the argument?
Well, I think it would be. I think that we have a good reason to think that perhaps one of these positions might be right. I think that we're in that position. One could endorse a stronger type of with appeal to the conciliatory insight and say, well, if it's entrenched long enough, maybe we should think that we ought not even traffic in the weaker doxastic attitudes, such as conjectures. Perhaps there could be an even stronger, right, type of conciliatory line there. I'm not sure what to say about that, if such an argument would be reasonable. I kind of tend to think that no matter how entrenched, if you can defend an argument defensively, you can respond to the opponent's objections, even if it just continues to be entrenched and experts continue to disagree, it strikes me that you're able to continue to make a weak assertive, right? You can assert weakly that something is the case and continue to conjecture. So I think I would maintain that you're going to continue to have that, but that's a good thing to think about.
Emil.
I thought about, you seem to stress a lot that the experts are supposed to be roughly divided, and was very worried about the comment about the 75-25 thing. And
yeah, very worried.
I was a little unsure what the motivation was for this like roughly divided thing. You seem some place in the paper to be sympathetic to considerations about the Condorcet theorem, and I was kind of thinking these fields just don't strike me as fields where you have where the independence requirement is satisfied at all. So I mean, why so much about the 50-50 thing? You might think that in certain fields, even though you have like 10% versus 90, you know, what you should really look at is like, are the 90% independent in how they form their judgment on it? So
that's a good point. I mentioned that the appeal to the Condorcet-Gerry theorem is one way to motivate the idea. However, I realize in retrospect that it would be really difficult to have philosophers satisfy that every plate, as you said. So I think that the argument would need to be motivated a different way, not by appealing to that, because I just don't think that's going to get satisfied. So in the revised version of the paper, I'm going to drop discussion of the Condorcet-Gerry theorem.
But it still doesn't answer the question of why you're stressing the roughly divided so much. I mean, what's it about? Why does it have to be 50-50? I mean, what is it that makes... It
doesn't have to be 50-50.
But
in fact, even more weakly, it just has to
be
that you're not... Pardon?
I mean, I'm asking, why can it be 95% saying something and 5% saying something else, and then you have to, like, be agnostic? I'm asking, what's important about the numbers? I mean, what motivates that it has to be roughly something? That's the question. It's not, you say it's not motivated by Condorcet. What's it motivated by?
Okay. So, what motivated me originally?
No. What motivates the idea that the experts have to be roughly divided in order for you to be agnostic?
No, I know that that's the question. I'm answering by saying, firstly, that what motivated me in trying to answer it was just that it struck me as obvious.
Oh, I see.
So. Obviously, you've now done the completely fair thing and say, well, why this rather than this? And aside from saying it strikes me as obvious, it strikes me as obvious in the same reason that it strikes me as obvious that if a bunch of people say one thing and one person says the other thing, don't have any independent reason to know who would be more likely right, that, well, chances are likely that a bunch of people are more right than the one person. It's the same type of insight that leads me to think that if experts, the people who are supposed to get it right, basically roughly if anyone could get it right, maybe that would be some informative thing to say in response to what you're saying. You already think of an expert as someone who's likely to get it right if anyone's going to get it right. If it's going to admit of the property of being the sort of thing that people can get right about, it's going to be the experts that do it. And if it turns out that clearly they're not because they're at tension with each other, something that will happen when they're roughly divided, then that's going to be a bad thing. Insofar as we should think that we are going to be responsible in trafficking in beliefs on the area.
But I just gave you a counterexample. Let's say they're roughly divided, but it turns out half of them, they're like, there's no independence. They hold the view because they're like so close to each other in the way they sort of form beliefs in the matter. But all the others, they're completely independent, but they're roughly divided, the experts. It seems like, you know, now the situation is kind of different. Though you might have a situation where you have a 90-10 distribution, but the 10%, they're like completely, they form the view completely independent of each other, but the last 90%, they're not at all independent. They're from the same, they're all educated from the same university or something like that in philosophy.
Oh, that's gosh, right. Okay, I'm sorry. All right, I got you.
That's one.
Okay, I thought you were asking a different question, which I didn't have anything to say other than that sounds obvious. Now I see that I appreciate it better. Gosh, that's tricky, isn't it? that's an awesome question. I don't have an answer.
So two quick follow-ups.
Yeah, just a quick follow-up. There's a paper, I think, by Jennifer Lackey, where she does say that even if there is dependence, that does not necessarily mean that there is no epistemic weight to be accorded to sort of consensus, for instance. Because suppose that you have like 10 NYU graduates who all believe the same. Then, nonetheless, I mean, they don't just have their advisor, hopefully. They have a lot of, you know, non-overlapping evidence anyway. So even though they came to that belief, not independently, but because their advisor believes it, they nonetheless have acquired skills that allow them to assess, you know, whether their advisor's belief is true.
Laura, anyway.
I really like that paper. I mean, because she also talks about how sometimes a group of people collaborating can actually be more reliable than people going off and trying to figure things out on their own. But I mean, if you're really worried about problematic dependence, so you believe P just because I told you that P, our collective beliefs shouldn't count twice as much as my, initial belief that P, that makes sense. You could just recast the whole thing in terms of, the independently formed expert opinions on P are roughly equally divided. I mean, you could just build that into the, if you still wanted to say what's important is that experts are roughly equally divided, you could just stipulate the independently formed expert opinions are roughly equally divided.
Yeah, I'd have to do that to get around that objection. So you're right that I can't simply specify roughly equivalent without some further remark about whether or not the experts are formed belief independently. So something like that would have to be built in order for me to specify the conditions under which the subject matter is epistemically dangerous in a way that would generate an order.
So trying to get to people who haven't had anything to say just yet, so fingers, who else had hands got bumped down? Christopher?
Yeah, I had a question about some of the stuff you and Laura were going back and forth on earlier about the Jamesian observation that we ought to provide equal weight to both truth and avoiding error. I thought this was interesting because some people, especially Tom Kelly, wants to take an opposite interpretation of kind of this sort of Jamesian observation and take it in a different direction, right? So Kelly wants to say, look, the fact that there's these completely different and discrete epistemic goods that are going on at the same time, what that means is that we actually can't give a sort of, agents can have different sort of weightings to these and be perfectly rational. So a sort of comparison to pragmatic rationality, some people are kind of adventurous and reward-seeking, and others are cautious and risk-averse. And maybe we think that people who are only risk-averse or people who are only reward-seeking are being pragmatically irrational. But it seems like there's a lot of kind of mushy room in the middle there for people to be fully rational and have kind of alternate ways for achieving the goods or avoiding the evils. And if you think that, you might think, well, look, even if it's really dangerous to wade into these philosophical waters where the experts seem to disagree, maybe if you're kind of adventurous or reward-seeking enough, it can be rational for you to engage in that enterprise.
I wonder how that would be an epistemic consideration that would bear on what type of an attitude you should take up, as opposed to a practical consideration.
I think the idea here is...
I agree you could have practical reasons to form a range of beliefs, and so that, but the type of undercutting defeater that would be in play here would be a undercutting normative defeater. The normativity that's at issue would be epistemic normativity.
Yeah, I'm taking it that the goods and risks are purely epistemic, right? So just like in the reward seeking and the risk avoiding cases and practical considerations, maybe purely pragmatic, maybe there's monetary reward and a risk of pain, right? The goods and evils avoided in the epistemic case are purely epistemic, it's just acquiring.
So you get a treasure trove of 100 free beliefs or something like that?
Well, yeah, you get more true beliefs, or you get more knowledge or more rational beliefs or whatever you think is epistemically most important, and you avoid, the relevant corresponding sort of epistemic error. But it seems like we can cash this out in a way that doesn't rely on bringing in pragmatic considerations, but it's purely looking at epistemic goods and evils.
Thanks. I mean, I've always found those cases weird. So Eric Olson talks about some of these types of cases and talking about the value of knowledge. He's like, well, because normally when you focus on what's the value of getting to the truth, what's the value of having the truth, you look at properties of that belief that aren't entirely explained as extrinsic vis-a-vis future true beliefs that you could get. And he tells a story about the value of truth, that it makes it more likely for you then to get more true beliefs. And of course, then cases arise, well, what if you form a belief in this particular way, you get 500 free true beliefs? Well, then is that an epistemically mandatory route to take? I mean, on one way of describing the scenario, yeah, it would be. If epistemic evaluation is evaluation that is understood as sort of something is epistemically valuable insofar as it's instrumentally valuable relative to some fundamentally or finally valuable epistemic good, and that good is true belief, then on the proposal that you're giving,
there could be consideration, there could be types of cases that you mentioned that would require that one maybe be certain in an epistemically dangerous area. I've always found something to be amiss about arguments that would argue for that way, but I'm not sure exactly where the problem I think lies in that type of thing.
Julie?
So, Adam, I feel there's a gap in the argument. I still don't see how it's felt. So it looks like the central argument has two premises. One is like the undercutting premise. If you have strong evidence that your belief that P is not reliably formed, then your belief that P is not justified. Or if you have enough evidence, let's say.
Oh, no. I would. That's a strong way of reading the conditions. That's one way of reading the conditions that are required for the structure of an undercutting defeater. I would go with Matheson's line and take a weaker idea, which is what I think is actually at play in philosophical pieces, where you simply just don't have enough evidence to think that the relevant experts in the area would be roughly in agreement on a particular topic. Which is why, like, I give a case in the paper called Ginger.
Sorry, so there is one notion of undercutting the feeder, which is I get evidence that my belief is not reliable.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's absolutely right.
And what you call an undercutting defeater is like it's stipulated, like, I mean, you just define an undercutting defeater as knowing that relevant experts in your area are split. Or do you?
So
is
this
like
this
by
is,
definition?
That's a good question. That's exactly what's at issue that I navigate the debate between Grundmann and Matheson on this point. Grundmann takes exactly the type of position you're saying. Look, there's one way to look at the structure of an undercutting defeater. It's when you have positive evidence that the evidence that you have doesn't indicate the truth of your belief. That's one way. And so that puts it incumbent on, I have to satisfy a stronger condition in Grundmann's case than I do in Matheson's case. According to Matheson, all that has to be the case is that I'm not certain. I have maybe strong uncertainty or hesitation about or something weaker than this, that the evidence is going to support the truth of the target.
Right, so my worry still goes through. So
okay.
If you have, so the principle is like, if there is enough doubt whether my current evidence support is indicative of the truth of P, then my belief that P is not justified.
Yeah.
Call that the undercutting principle. Let's grant that. Now, I don't see how the fact that people who have more evidence than you are split entails anything about whether your evidence indicates the truth, precisely because they have different evidence. So at most it shows that their evidence doesn't indicate the truth, because, you know, on their evidence half of them go pee, half of them go
yeah.
not pee. But what about, this has no implication for your evidence. Same if you go in the reliability kind of format.
Right. So the way that I try to fill in the gap in the paper is by giving a very specific idea of what type of a thing a belief is on the doxastic hierarchy. And so if a belief is the type of attitude that you should take up only under certain situations in which the aim of avoiding error is weighted in a particular way, that will be weighted differently when one takes up the attitude of merely suspecting that something is so. If that's the case, then I can say that the fact of expert disagreement, whether I be suspicious that there is such a fact, even if that's the case, makes it such that I ought not to traffic largely in the attitude that happens to be belief, an attitude that gives a certain premium on avoiding error.
Let me just
and so
try
that's,
one more
that's the normative undercutting defeater, at least on the proposal I give.
I'll try one more line and then I
yeah.
Suppose I'm a super adverse wearer. I want to avoid error at all costs. Now, the fact that people who have more evidence disagree show that if I had more evidence, I should avoid belief. But I don't have more evidence, so I don't see why it should entail that on my current evidence, which is not theirs, I should refrain from believing because there is a risk of error. I don't see how you derive there is a risk of error given my evidence.
I'm not sure why you don't see that.
It doesn't follow.
Okay.
It doesn't follow from the fact that experts disagree that my belief isn't probable on my evidence. That's what the question is.
Oh.
About. So how do you get from the fact that experts
yeah,
disagree
yeah.
that belief isn't probable on my
okay.
evidence?
Okay. I have a slippery premise in between those two, which you might want to attack. So the premise that links these two ideas is that if it's the case that experts are roughly split on subject matter that's central to a particular area, then I say the following is true. Then you ought not to traffic largely in beliefs in that area, and that has to do with facts about beliefs being individuated with ways to do with risking error. So then I say that that moment of facts in place.
It's not undercutting at all, and it's not via an undercutting principle that Julian articulated.
Well, I think it is undercutting for the reason that you now should not think that the evidence that you have justifies you informing, and here's the trick or whatever, justifies you informing beliefs. Beliefs is the wrong attitude. So that's supposed to be the key. So no longer should you think, if once I've got this fact in play, that the epistemic, that the experts disagree, and then it's the case that I should not traffic largely in beliefs, then my idea is that even if I have some other completely independent piece of evidence to think that P is true, I should think that that warrants me in taking up the attitude of belief. So that's how it is an undercutting defeater.
So Alex, wanted to get a
yes.
So I think there are a couple of different ways there's a disconnect here. One is, I think Julian is implicitly adopting a view about the norms that govern the rationality of beliefs that maybe you don't accept. So you seem to have this Jamesian view, right? Like it's a matter of,
I'm only Jamesian in the sense that I think that doxastic attitudes might be individuated, as he says, with respect to not just the goal of attaining truth, but also avoiding error.
All right.
So I'm not like a crazy pragmatist.
Right. So, but I think what Julian's saying here, look, the only thing that matters, right, in evaluating whether or not my belief is, I'm permitted to have a certain sort of belief, is whether or not my evidence permits me to have that kind of belief, right? And I think what you're not saying as clearly as you could be saying is that, look, when you become aware of the fact that experts with respect to a certain proposition are roughly divided on that proposition, that fact is evidence that gets incorporated into your total evidence. And that once it gets incorporated into your total evidence, you're no longer permitted to believe anything with respect to P. The only thing you're able to do is withhold it.
Yeah.
And so I think what some people might object to is, wow, I mean, that fact that experts roughly are divided on this subject is such a powerful piece of evidence. It totally washes out any sort of positive epistemic effects that your first order evidence might have. I think some people might find that really implausible. Now, I mean, it might be that maybe you have to downgrade your confidence a little bit, but downgrading your confidence a little bit still might be compatible with having full-blown belief on that subject matter. So I think where the weakness or the unclarity of the argument is in getting that piece of evidence about experts being roughly divided to be of such a tremendous evidential import that it warrants not just a little bit of downgrading confidence, but full-blown withdrawal of belief to withholding.
So I agree with your characterization and the way that I could explain how the structure of normative undercutting defeat would then play into the idea that Julian has vis-a-vis evidence. What I would reject, though, is the idea that very much is really going on once you discover this fact. So you mentioned that, wow, that fact seems to be doing an awful lot of work. On the proposal that I want to give, well, it isn't that much work. It might just be that the slightly weaker attitude that we ought to continue now. Basically, we continue to think that the evidence that we originally had for believing P, where P is a proposition in some epistemically dangerous subject matter, continue to think that that evidence points maybe very strongly in favor of adopting a representational state towards P. And you don't really think any differently about that. All you do is you think, well, but now I merely suspect that P. And the suspicion, by the way, when I say representative attitudes, these are things that are beholden to truth in a way that, as a standard of correctness, don't differ from belief, just like being certain that P, believing that P, suspecting that P. These are things that are correct if P is true, right? So I don't think that you should think about your evidence pointing to your belief any differently other than just, and that's why it's a slightly different style of undercutting argument, because what's really you're worried about isn't the evidence anymore. It's just, or its connection to the representational state, it's just that you don't worry that you're trafficking in slightly the wrong epistemic state. You should say, I merely conjectured that P. And I continue to conjecture that P on the same types of considerations that led me to originally say that I believe that P.
Did John have a finger?
Just a little thing. I mean, I'm puzzled just to try and make sense of it in connection with what you actually say in the paper. And what you say in the paper is, we ought to believe that trafficking in certain beliefs is doxastically responsive.
Yeah.
What you said about undermining is, we should have weaker epistemic states with regards to philosophical subject matters.
Yeah.
If we add in that beliefs about what's doxastically responsible are epistemically dangerous subject matters, then your view is incoherent.
yeah, it is. So I'd have to tone that down to suspect. Yeah. So in the paper when I said
you're thinking that mere suspicion that trafficking, that you're being doxastically responsible, already makes it that none of your beliefs are responsible. I mean, that just sounds pretty wild, so, doesn't it? I don't know.
So I don't think that it's wild to think that mere suspicion that experts are roughly divided is a problem.
No, it's not
that.
That
your worry is that just the suspicion that I might be ducks.
Yes, that seems a bit rough to say that. I mean, I know some people that, but it seems a bit
rough to say.
When you downgrade that to suspicion, then.
All right. Well, that is a good catch, and obviously that is something that I have to change, unless I say this. No, it's fine to continue to hold that belief. It's the belief is in place and it's doing certain work. And then once that does the relevant work to generate the undercutting to fear, then you should simply refrain from adopting
so
the belief.
Okay, that's a special
that's
exception
just throwing
where it is okay
ladder
to have beliefs about philosophically dangerous subject matters. It's okay to have them while they destroy everything else.
Well, that is, you have them until they destroy everything else. And then you throw it away. However, there's another line that I could take on there and say that the objection, which is to say that there's an incoherence there, can be dissolved by suggesting that the subject matter of doxastic irresponsibility, it might remain an open question whether that's a particular area on which experts are divided.
Yes, but I mean, there are possible.
In fact, they actually are divided.
Remember, there
so
are possible worlds where they're divided, and this should be a normative theory about other worlds too. And so you might as well just go to a world where they're divided.
I didn't
get about the sociology.
I didn't realize that I used the word belief there, so I could either do one of two things. I can say no, it does play the role of belief, but then once it plays the role of being an undercutting defeater, then you should only suspect that that was the case. That's a little weird. The other approach is just to say that the right attitude would be something less, a conjecture or something, and then explain how conjecture can do the relevant work vis-a-vis the proposition about doxastic responsibility. So I would have to do one of those two things. I can't just keep it.
Sam, do you want to ask the last question?
All right, sure.
Okay. Next on my list is Danny, if you can make it fast.
Yeah, so at the end of your paper, you say you've got an undercutting defeater for all your philosophical beliefs, and then...
Oh, I backed off of that.
Then you say it's pretty easy to see how it could generalize to other domains, particularly religion and politics. So, I found that pretty fast and quick. Like, here's one way to think that the matters in religion are very different. So, on some pretty popular views in the Christian tradition, for example, sin has a negative intellectual impact, and therefore people who disagree with you be considered sinners. It doesn't generate these kinds of epistemic worries in exactly the same way that you're thinking they're generating them in philosophy. So if you're going to generalize to religion, I think there's some, a more advanced argument going to be.
Thank you for raising that point. First off, that was a hand-wavy remark when I said that this might generalize to religion, partly because this is a religious epistemology event, and I considered that there might make a connection there. But Laura raised a worry there that in her comments that's very similar to that, which suggests that, no, I shouldn't even wave a hand and suggest that there might be implications because there's something that's distinctively different about religious disputes and religious expertise and philosophy. And the thing that I believe you said was that it might be the case that one has a religious experience that constitutes evidence, and the experts might be evidence in virtue of having certain religious experiences that are non-accessible to someone else. And I don't think I responded to that in my reply, but what I was thinking in response of this type of worry to try to cleave a dissymmetry is to say that, well, the same might be the case in the metaphysics of abstract objects. It might well be that I have no idea what the relevant items of evidence, I'm just too dumb to appreciate that Lewis and Van Inwagen know about this topic. But it might be the case that just the bare fact of recognizing that they both, one says P, the other says not P, that's enough to do it, right? And I need not be privileged to know what their evidence on the topic is. But if that's the case, then mutatis mutandis in the religious case, the fact of inaccessible evidence wouldn't cleave a disanalogy. But if what you're saying is right, and the point about sinners, that could force the two areas apart. I think there are some areas in which they're similar, but I'll stop.
Okay. But sorry. Thanks very much. We're over time, so thanks to Laura and Adam for.